So I want to know from you, the viewers, comment and let us know whether you would be happy with an excellent doctor that can treat your condition, but he doesn't care about you, he doesn't talk to you. He's not horrible to you, he just doesn't care about your life. Or would you want a doctor that speaks sweet words to you, says nice things, but he's not, he doesn't really know what's cutting. Mm. Hello and welcome to Let's Talk Man. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. My name is Dr. Cyril Essa, and joined with me in the studio is
Dr. Brendan Matthews,
Dr. Ntantla Vilagadzi,
Dr. Vishen Naidu.
And today we're going to be talking about a lot of things. As usual, we're going to be starting off with an interesting case from the week. Vish, I believe you did something interesting this week. What happened this week?
Yeah, so, you know, we were talking about previously, we talked about priapism and patients who present with, these types of diseases. So a lot of the times in state, you know, it's very difficult to treat these patients. I mean, if they have any complications post surgical treatment.
Just before we carry on, I think a lot of people are probably wondering, what is priapism?
Exactly.
So So priapism is prolonged or sustained erection for more than 4 hours without any sexual stimuli. There can be different causes, but such causes where there can be ischemia or necrosis to the tissue, which could render the penis dead or not working. You know, in future. So, I mean, you can do the theater procedures to relieve the pain and get the blood out. But in essence, how do these patients actually continue living day to day? Because they aren't able to get normal erections, you know, once they discharge and once they're at home. So this past week, we actually had the fortunate activity of doing a penile prosthesis.
Ooh. Penile prosthesis?
Mm. Yeah.
That's nice.
What is the...
I'm just trying to, trying to imagine what it could be. Like, what, you guys put like a balloon in there?
You guys, so if you have a look.
Oh, okay.
So this one was from Boston Scientific.
What is that?
Wait, do you pump?
You pump it up when you want to have an erection.
So there's a reservoir right at the top where you can, which goes basically subcutaneously.
Okay.
And you have the pump, which lies in the scrotum. Essentially, those two rods sit inside the penis.
Yeah.
So essentially that's a closed system filled with saline, and when the patient wants to have an erection, he just pumps. Mm. There's a button in the scrotum where he uses the pump, and those rods inflate with the saline.
Oh, wow, that's interesting stuff. So it's possible for your dick to explode.
There's different sizes of this. So while you're doing the operation, there's different cc's of the actual rods. Mm, mm, okay. So
wait, now if I wanted to get extra girth now, could I just say, no, I want the biggest size?
Put it inside me.
No, so the thing is, it's somewhat dependent on the actual tissue that you have.
Yeah.
So the length of the rods are different. You can also increase the length of the rods by adding on extra length.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously depending on the girth of the actual rod that needs to be inserted. Sometimes, you know, the actual bodies of the penis. So in the normal penis, there's two corpora cavernosum, which is at the top, and then the spongiosum, which is the urethra at the bottom.
Mm.
So essentially, sometimes when these patients have extensive scar tissue after the priapism, it's actually very difficult to get a good channel through them to put these rods in. Because essentially, you need to get a tunnel through them so these rods can go in.
Yo. So where does the pump actually sit? The guy has a pump like...
In the scrotum.
Oh, it's in the scrotum?
In the scrotum.
But then so the actual scrotum now where...
You pump it in the scrotum?
I mean the testy, then...
No. So it's also subcutaneous in the scrotum.
Okay.
Okay.
But you pump from the
scrotum. So you'll be able to feel the bulb. You'll be able to feel the pump in the scrotum. So each time want to have the erection, you just pump the bulb
So you pump it up until it gets to the desired...
Until to the desired, yeah.
Yeah. That's cute. Like things like satisfaction and...
No, so orgasm would still be fine because your nerve function would still be intact.
Okay.
And the stimulation is
the
there.
The stimulation is still intact as well.
Yeah.
Yo, that's cool, man. Crazy, man.
And how much would this... you know, I'm asking for a friend, not myself.
Sure.
if I just wanted to add it in there.
Cost.
So I know the device is close to 200,000.
200?
Yeah. Okay. Just the device.
And this, they're providing it in government, in state?
No, this was unfortunately just a workshop that we had.
So,
But in private practice, you obviously are more than welcome to pay for it. And
wait, now, for example, could a patient just walk in and say, you know what, I'm not having the erections I want?
No, so there's certain indications for putting in this prosthesis. One of the most common indications is post-priapism, where obviously the tissue is just scar tissue. Yeah. You can't achieve normal erections.
And don't work.
Hectic.
I have a question, man. So let's say for some reason I decided I'm going to take Xenon or Mbesu or something, and then I ended up now with priapism.
You know,
and now my penis can't work anymore because I decided I want to eat the root of a tree in Limpopo.
Yeah. Which works, by the way.
So let's say I get...
okay. I'm speaking from experience.
So let's say I get this device, Vish, implanted. Is there a way that, you know, I can meet a girl or get a partner and inflate that thing without her knowing that I'm inflating it? Like, can I do it, you know, secretly and then just get a boner without her knowing, you know, maybe during while you're kissing... You know, because now if I have to say, baby, just wait.
So realistically, so I can tell you. So the patients actually, they actually think they are like Superman. Because technically, even after their orgasm, they still have an erection. They can still continue. You know, they can continue even when, say, for example, they're not in the mood. You know?
Can you imagine that? You can literally go for hours then.
But the sensation,
The sensation, it's still there.
You can relive your priapism.
No, you'll still have, you might not have physical response of refractory period, but you'll be like,
it won't be as.
Yes, but if your partner is
like,
you can just carry on.
Yeah.
Yo. So they can basically just relive their priapism.
Yeah.
Just have another six hour.
So obviously all of this is internal. So, I mean, for anyone that does know, like you wouldn't be able to see anything with the naked eye.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you are fondling the scrotum, you'd be able to obviously feel something in there.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's going to be a no-go zone.
Yeah, don't touch.
No one touches. Yeah.
Now that don't takes things sphere. Out of the sexual experience. What if that person is into that thing and now...
Yeah. Into what thing? Pumping into your scrotum? Who has ever come and said, no, this is what I like?
That's you all never I want.
Know. Guys, do you know who that is? Who's that picture? I actually found that the word, you know, in medicine, a lot of our terms come from Greek and Latin. That's priapus. So Priapus was apparently a Greek god who had a potent shaft, as you can see there in the picture.
Shaft was gifted.
The shaft was
so
powerful.
This almost looks like he's transected his suspensory ligament for extra length. So for everyone that doesn't know, there are people who do procedures to transect the suspensory ligament, which is at the dorsum or the top of the penile base.
Yeah.
So they get extra length. That's, you know, Dr. Long and whoever you see on the...
So they are sort of cords that you could cut.
Yeah.
That basically keep it in a
certain
shape.
Get extra length, but it's almost like downwards angling.
So then you just have like...
Just this dangling shaft.
Dangling.
Just a long,
and is the erection
shaft.
Still as strong?
Eh?
Is the erection...
Doesn't affect the erection at
impotence,
all.
Impotence.
It would be at a very abnormal angle.
Okay. But the actual strength of the erection, nothing. There's no problem with the blood flow or something.
No.
Okay.
So Priapus was cursed so that he could never get an erection again. Because
It doesn't look like he needs it.
Yeah.
I'm sure the other gods were jealous, being
suspended.
Yeah.
He's holding it by his elbow there.
But yeah, I thought that. Yeah, can you see?
That's his suspensory ligament.
I'd like to read more about.
Also looks like he has phimosis.
Eh?
Oh yeah, that also.
Oh, so yeah, the foreskin.
He needs to circumcise the man.
No, but legend
but
has
back
it.
Back in his time, it wasn't.
It wasn't an issue.
It wasn't a thing,
but legend has it that he was cursed to become impotent. Because I suspect all the other gods were just like, this man is chowing all our woman.
So that's what happens with typism. So it ends up being like that where you actually can't get an erection anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Then you have to put in the prosthesis.
Course, So but there is actually an alternative.
Could I not just request...
I guess.
If I had erectile dysfunction, I can't get it.
So, unknown cause. And
so there's multiple different treatments, obviously, for erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
The chances are you would probably respond to some sort of line of treatment for erectile dysfunction, whether it's sildenafil or any of the PDE5 type of drugs or prostaglandins or introcop, where you have to inject into the penis to get you would probably
things.
Respond to... To some sort. So those things actually can cause priapism as well.
But there are many people out there who get strokes. A stroke can potentially affect your erection.
Sure,
or
a spinal cord injury.
Yes, a stab or gunshot to the spine. Yeah. People who are paraplegic.
But then putting in that penile prosthesis, they wouldn't be able to ejaculate then if they've got a spinal
cord injury. So they would have ejaculatory dysfunction as well.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can really do about that. But you were saying something about there are other...
So there are other alternatives to this specific penile prosthesis.
Yeah. Yeah.
So actually in the Middle East, they do quite a lot of these operations, penile prosthesis, but there is an alternative which is a lot more cheaper.
Yeah.
It's called a malleable penile prosthesis.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no inflatability of it. It's pretty much just malleable, as the word suggests. Those rods that go into the penis.
Yeah.
And it would pretty much stay the same length. Yeah. So if you need to use it, you would adjust the angle.
So there's just the... Okay. You go from down to just...
And you just
then
put
it stays in that position.
I mean, that's...
Literally, just bend it and then it's there.
Remember
that you... We haven't actually done that one, but that is an alternative.
Yeah, why are they doing that in the Middle East specifically?
Cost factors, it's much cheaper.
And everything is being done there anyway. I mean, BBLs and all these.
In the Middle East.
No, that was Turkey.
Oh, it's Turkey.
Turkey is still a Muslim country, right?
It is.
But it's a more liberal one. So that's why they're more.
But
I wonder why, though, in the Middle East.
Yeah.
These things have their places in people's lives, you know? Because why is someone putting... Let's say you have nerve injury, you had a stroke, you're quadriplegic, right? You still... Even if you're not feeling the sex, right? You have a partner.
Yeah.
Sex is between two people.
Yeah, of course.
So let's say now you're quadriplegic, you're in a wheelchair, you have a wife or girlfriend or whoever who loves you and looks after you and washes you and helps you and feeds you, but she doesn't get one thing from you and she's like, nah... I'm leaving this guy. Now you're losing your helper. Who's going to bath you? Who's going to push your wheelchair? Who's going to feed you? She just wants this one thing.
It's been a long day.
Just sit, baby.
You're just a malleable.
Exactly.
You just adjust.
You know, so at least take care of her, you know?
Yeah,
because
she's
taking care of you as
well. But tell me, Avish, what are the complications? Are there any complications with the penile prosthesis?
No, definitely. So, I mean, not really... common, but I mean, there can be a rupture of the actual reservoir that's there. You can, with any prosthetic or any prosthesis, you can have sepsis or any infection, in which case it may need to be removed.
Yeah,
there hasn't been that many cases or reported cases of sepsis, but you know, ultimately, after the operation, you want to keep these patients on antibiotics, make sure the wound is clean, healed.
Yeah.
We actually don't activate the actual device until after 6 weeks. So essentially, you want the tissue to heal.
Must heal nicely
around the prosthesis. And then in terms of, I mean, I know public-private in this country is treated very differently and patients are treated very differently. My question is, in private, I'm sure people can just request for an operation, like if you have the money to pay.
Sure.
Do you think
good enough medical aid? Hey?
Do you think I would do it for you?
Yeah. Do you think you would consider?
If we came to you and we said, "Listen, I want on demand,
on demand, inflatable,"
like look, the Michelin man. Just
once I've qualified as a urologist.
Yeah.
You can come to my practice.
Yeah. Wait, yeah. Yeah, and I'm assuming you're going to go into private and not stay at Helen Joseph where you used to work. Moving swiftly on to Helen Joseph, recently in the past week, there was a ex-broadcast journalist by the name of Tom London who released a scathing video about his 14-day stay at Helen Joseph Hospital where he received poor treatment, complained about the infrastructure of the hospital. Yeah. And the staff, particularly the WITS medical students that assisted in his care, as well as the doctors that treated him. And today we're going to break down all of his complaints and chat about our opinions on what we think actually went down. So here we have a picture of him at Helen Joseph and then at Morningside. Clearly they even shave you there.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
We need to survive it. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes.
Like you can even see the change. Person. The light in his face is different, man. Mm. Helen Joseph, the light
they
is different.
They give you a ring light when you take videos. Again.
You're an influencer now. Yeah. And,
well, you are an influencer.
Yeah, yeah. He is. He is. So, yeah, Tom London, he used to be a talk radio host on 702, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Sister Bettina. That's Sister Bettina, by the way. Yeah. In the back. Sister Bettina
she's the resident nurse.
She's our resident nurse. She's
Sister
behind
Bettina.
behind the scenes. Yeah. That's Sister Bettina for our show. So yeah, he's an ex-broadcast journalist. He was on Radio 702 talk show host. I don't know what he does now, but he was for many years. And then he was admitted at a hospital called Helen Joseph, which is in the West Rand.
Like Auckland Park.
Yeah, Auckland Park. It's surrounded by, a lot of gang violence. It's surrounded by like West Dean.
Coloureds.
Hey, I didn't want to say it.
That's true.
So yeah, I mean, it's a hospital that's been under scrutiny for many years. And obviously, I get it. He made a very valid complaint. Most of us here have either visited in our time training at WITS. We visited the hospital for our training or actually worked there at some point. So we know how terrible the conditions are there. And so to some extent, I suppose we can empathize with the situation.
Yeah.
But it's just, for me, it's the motives behind why you would go and do this. Because he goes and he makes a complaint, right? And in his complaint, he complains mainly about three things. He complains about the infrastructure. And it starts, his video starts, if you remember. Play the video. He starts.
So doctors that run around here, they treat the patients like cockroaches. No doctor, I haven't seen one doctor walk up to a patient in our ward and go, "Good morning, Mr. So-and-so, how are you?" Nothing. They treat the patients with absolute disdain and disrespect. I'm talking about this from the young WITS medical students all the way up the chain at this hospital. I have never seen a level of disrespect for human beings like this in my life.
Yeah, so that's the one thing. I think that was towards the end of his video.
Yeah.
So the whole video is about 5 minutes long. But in the beginning, he starts talking about, obviously, the
infrastructure.
The infrastructure. He starts filming the ward that he's in, the toilets, the bathtub, the taps that don't work, the ceiling that's cracking and there's leaking. And then he goes on a tirade about the doctors. Now, I get the infrastructure issue. And I thought, someone who has a background in journalism obviously is going to go, okay, I understand how to report the story.
Yeah.
Because the problem here surely is the infrastructure. It can't just be about the doctors. I think it's like super naive to think that we run the hospital.
Yeah.
We are staff of the hospital. We don't manage every single aspect of the hospital at large. But, like,
yeah. So I think he raised a very valid point which is something that interested me, that, you know, people are losing, or doctors say are losing, patient-centeredness. I mean, people seeing patients and not greeting them. I mean, it's happened. I mean, it happens to me sometimes, especially in a very busy clinic or busy, ward. It's very easy to think you said hi and introduced yourself to a patient, but because you're in such a rush, you know, you look at the file, you look at the condition of the patient, you know, there's so much happening. And I don't think there's a lot of like deep thought that people put into this to say, you know what, I'm getting in this ward, I'm not going to greet anyone.
I think what people should realize about the profession is that I don't think anyone deliberately does that.
Yeah, like to have the intention to go in and say, like,
I'm not going to like screw this person or whatever. Yeah. And that's not to make an excuse. We should be doing that.
Exactly.
And it comes back to the training, right? He made mention of Wits Medical School, which we all attended. And we know this for a fact, right? Yeah. Firstly, I remember when we were Wits Medical students, when we would get examined clinically. So for those of you who don't know how med school works, basically you have 4 years of just pure like studying. You're in a lecture hall, you're doing lectures and then writing exams. Actually, in your third and fourth year, you are starting to do clinical exams where they have a patient in front of you, a simulated patient, and a case that you need to obviously go about doing a diagnosis and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the rubric, on the marking rubric, greeting your patient and asking them what their name or how they're doing is part of that marking.
And getting consent,
like saying, can I do this procedure on you or whatever, is part of the training. So to say that, you know, we're not trained properly to do this, like to obviously criticize, because he criticized the medical schools, they don't teach this and we don't, that's not the truth. Now, obviously, for some people, it comes naturally. In a class of, how many did we have? Like maybe 300 people. In a class of 300, you're going to obviously find people who just genuinely didn't have the natural knack for talking to people. They were not that social in the way that they interact with their patients. It's not something that obviously comes natural to everybody, but it's not as though it wasn't mandated that we had to greet our patients and we had to ask for consent.
Yeah.
And we had to make sure that our patient is comfortable before we touching them or doing any procedure on them. And I remember like recently, I'm sure you recently also, now that we're doctors, we also sometimes take the exams for new medical students.
Mm-hmm.
And I had meetings after the exams and the examining committee, we had to fail a guy because I had the digital rectal exam station. That means it's the exam for putting the finger in the bum and checking the prostate, right? And they have a model there on the table. This student walks in, doesn't say hello. So obviously he just saw a bum, like a hanging bum there. He obviously didn't think there's a human. Maybe if it was a real patient, he would have said hello and whatever. But he doesn't even say hello. Then he looks at me and he was like, okay, I'm going to get started. So I was like, all right, sure. He didn't ask for permission.
Yeah.
So I'm meant to be the examiner, just sitting in a corner, marking him on a tick sheet. Doesn't say hello, whatever. Just takes lube, puts his finger in. Now, In the examining committee, they were like, okay, I see you marked him down for this. Like, what happened? And I said this thing, and they were like, yeah, we're failing him for the station. He's not going to pass that station.
Yeah.
How can you just put your finger in someone's bum and you haven't even said hello or asked them for permission? So I think we must just rectify that misconception that the medical schools don't teach us to be decent to our patients. But obviously, there's this like natural thing. You either have it or you don't.
I think there's two aspects. There's two aspects that then counter what you've been taught. Number one would probably be your personality. So just who you are as a person and, you know, how you interact with other people. And then secondly, let's be honest, when we start going to hospitals, what are the examples that we see from our seniors who are there? You know, you're a student, or a junior doctor, you've just finished medical school, and now you start attending ward rounds, and you have seniors, the consultants, specialists, who come to the bedside and straight go to the file and take out the x-rays, and what's the blood results, and what's happening? Oh, okay, we didn't see this yesterday. Here's the cancer. Okay, you'll tell the patient that he has cancer.
Yeah.
Let's go to the next bed. Yeah. I mean, obviously, dramatizing
the patient,
you're
actually just saying X, Y, and Z, and the patient is lying there in the bed.
Yes.
Just hearing, like, or even if you're not even, you're saying what could be a differential, where it could be an infection, it could be a cancer or like a cannonball lesion or something. And, you know, someone might answer, oh, it can be cancer. And then the patient just hears, like, cancer.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And so I've seen some professors or some of our specialist consultants will go to the patient and say, listen, we're going to have a discussion. Not and everything not is about you.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Just so that you feel comfortable, like, this is for our own teaching. Yeah.
So there's definitely good examples that people
and there's also
sit.
Equally yeah. bad examples. Yeah. I remember bad many examples. Bad examples. But the weird thing about this video is how he criticized the medical students. I remember when we all were medical students, none of us, we all were like very much like, hey, how are you greeting the patient? Generally, our colleagues, as you go through the system, by the time you're getting into your internship, whatever, the system breaks you so much where you like, you have no time to sleep, no time to think. You're doing the jobs not only of yourself, but you're pushing patients. You're a porter, you're a nurse, you're a radiographer. You're everything in that hospital. And it's not to make any excuse for treating a patient badly, but sometimes you're not going to be the nicest to patients as you were when you were a medical student. So this claim that like medical students are also bad, now as a doctor who works in an academic hospital, so there are students coming in, I see the way patients are treated by medical students. Yeah. And they're far, far better than some of my colleagues even. Mm-hmm. You know, they take the time, they take the care. They're obviously fresh out of medical school. They're taught to greet, to introduce themselves, to ask for consent, whatever. They are probably like the best when it comes to a patient-centered approach. So I just found that weird, that students are also now like...
Also part of this,
Let me give you an example So I was doing exams for the students, the final year students. Yeah. So I'm sitting there in the corner and the student walks in and of course the patient is there. And then I don't know the guy. he's... obviously knew me because he walked in and he was like, hi, Breezy. I'm like, okay, this guy knows me.
Breezy? And he even called you Breezy?
Yeah. But then he sits down opposite the patient and then he says, you have chest pain. Tell me about your chest pain. And he takes the history. And I'm thinking, you greet me, you don't greet your patient.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm the examiner. You're not even supposed to see me in the corner. But you... So I had to fail the bra because, I mean, you know, his history wasn't good either. But, maybe he was scared because I was there. I don't know.
No, I wanted to say that, I mean, I think you did point that out, the fact that, you know what, we as seniors, not seniors per se, but, you know, you a senior, for example.
Yeah,
in family
we've worked
medicine,
in the, yeah.
What we do really trickles down to the younger generation. And if you are not... which a lot of people are, you know, not well sort of mannered. And I mean, sometimes there are sort of grounds to explain why people can be like that. I mean, when you're alone and seeing 60, 70 people, it is very difficult to, you know, to...
And I don't think the layman really understands that pressure.
Exactly.
Like, we've been groomed to understand that pressure, but I really don't think, like... Okay, take any service industry that anyone may be, because a lot of the lay people online go like, there's no reason, there's no excuse for you to be like this. I'm like, you don't understand. Even if you're a cashier, do you see 70 people a day? Do you even as a cashier, do you see 70 people a day? And not 70 people that are just there for you to scan their groceries. 70 people who are sick, who are dying, who are demanding your attention. Like demanding, they want, sometimes, especially for somebody like me who works in the emergency, people will demand things. I want a CT scan. Why? Because Google said so. All right, so and why then, did I study
And then
for
the
six
next
years
person who comes is in is dying. And if you're not on your A game persistently, people can die.
Yeah.
You need to be like all the time. But let's talk about maybe reasons why. Let's maybe try and do a root cause analysis as to why that sometimes... we might lose our humanity. You brought up if you sing 67.
Before we address that, and this is something I want all of us to weigh in on. Do we think that Tom London, his accusations about doctors, do you think it's the majority of doctors that are like that? I'm not saying whether it's deliberate or indeliberate. Do you think, because I know as a student, and we were speaking about that, there were times where I'd see really terrible patient, like bedside manner, where I saw horrible treatment of doctors by, specialists even towards their patients. Patients who have been waiting in a queue since 4 a.m., taking a taxi to come there. They sit in a clinic queue for like 6 hours just to see you, and you don't even have respect for them. Obviously, you've just seen 20 other people. You obviously are tired yourself. You may have even been working the night before and the day before. It's now, you're on hour number 28 of your shift. Like, people don't even realize that, that mm-hmm. those are the work hours that we work. But okay. it's still no excuse for treating somebody like trash. But I also equally, and in fact, not equally, more so saw good doctors. People who yeah. really genuinely cared. But I don't know, what's your experience?
No, I don't think that the majority of doctors in the country are what Tom London is describing. Yeah. I remember the first time he speaks about doing a lumbar puncture. The patient opposite to me was crying.
So just mm-hmm. explain what a lumbar puncture
so
is.
So a lumbar puncture is basically, so ladies would know, ladies who've had a C-section would know it as an epidural or spinal when they put the needle in your back.
Yeah.
Okay. So you can also do that same test to get water out of the spine, which is the same water around the brain, and then you test it for infections and so forth.
Yeah.
My first experience as a student, a final year medical student, the first time I was taught how to do a lumbar puncture, the person teaching me never used anesthetic.
Yeah, so just using some sort of just
numbing agent
around that area before you put the needle in.
To reduce the pain. Yeah. I was taught you just go in with the needle and the person's like, screaming. It is painful.
Of course, putting a needle in your spine is extremely painful.
Luckily, when I did do it again as a junior doctor, the person then teaching me taught me the whole process that you put your lignocaine, give the patient 5 minutes, come back, and now there should be no pain, as much pain when you put the needle in.
Yeah. So it's quite a large needle. That spinal needle is a much bigger needle than a normal needle.
There are, and it's not the majority, but we must admit that there are doctors who take shortcuts, who perhaps do things not to the book, and perhaps don't have the humanity or personality. But again, we can find out why that is. Maybe there were 50 lumbar punctures waiting to be done.
Going back to the service and the system, maybe there was just no lignocaine available.
Exactly.
And you didn't know this.
That's a reality
that we must face. Yeah. Like maybe there are times where, and all of us have faced resource shortages. There are times where literally there's no gloves.
Yes.
No gloves.
At one point, I mean, there was no catheter bags.
There were no catheter bags. Can you imagine you're putting in a catheter? Where's the urine going to go?
Exactly.
You've got no water. There was a time I mentioned this in my video online about Helen
Joseph.
There's
still no water in some hospitals.
Yeah. No water. They had to get, Gift of the Givers, an NGO had to help our government. A non-governmental organization was doing the work of the government.
Of the government.
Came through, brought a JoJo tank.
That was to Helen Joseph.
To Helen Joseph. And this is the reality. Like, obviously, you look at us and you go, like, you're bad, you're terrible. But you don't know all the structural issues we are facing. Like, imagine if we had no local anesthetic to numb you. Now you think I'm a terrible person because I'm not doing it. But if I don't do this test, I can't find out what's wrong with you. I can't treat you. So would I rather not treat you at all? Or you suffer a bit of pain now and we actually get to that diagnosis knowing we're in this shit system together.
But I think maybe also to explain to the patient that, look, there's no lignocaine. I have to do this.
True. Exactly. That's what I wanted to say. I mean, it still doesn't take away the fact that they're human beings. Imagine it was you.
Of course.
Right? Mm. I mean, you have a choice and whoever's administering whatever they're giving to you, they should give you the full spec of what's going on.
100%.
Like, for example, I take the hospital I work in. You know, I'm in the eye department and we have a huge shortage of lenses.
Mm.
And I mean, lenses is not like a catheter bag. It's not like it's your vision forever.
Yeah.
Right? So we can't just put a lens that we feel like putting in because there's no 22, there's a 21. You understand? Yeah, and we have to tell patients that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We have to sit your patient down. You have to tell them this is what's going on. These are the challenges. And some patients will say, you know what? I mean, I haven't been seeing anything. I haven't seen my grandkids forever. Can you just put something there? But, I mean, things like that take away from your humanity. Yeah. They take away from doctors. Mm. And you find, I mean, sitting down and telling someone, listen, you deserve this, but I'm going to put something that's really, really, really going to make your vision blurry. I mean, also says something about you and your training. How do you think that's fine?
Yeah.
Mm. You know, one of my consultants even pointed out, we were actually having an M&M meeting, which is a morbidity mortality meeting. And
Issues around like patients, let's say you've had a surgery that didn't go well. Why didn't it? Let's break it down. The mortality, talking about deaths that happened in your unit. Why? What could we avoid?
Yeah, but most importantly, what could we have done better? Sort of a learning experience. And so this one guy presented something similar to that but it wasn't intentional, someone was given an incorrect, it's like a prescription glass. Think of it that way.
Yeah.
They gave you an incorrect prescription glass after you paid 12,000 rand for those glasses.
Yeah,
right?
yeah, yeah.
And the reason for that was because there were problems with measurements.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really that they didn't have a particular lens. They just did the measurements wrong. So then one of the other consultants raised the point and said, but that's not a mortality, morbidity.
Mm.
And another senior consultant said, well, in the eye department, in ophthalmology, patients don't die from eye operations. Mm. So to us, that's mortality, morbidity.
If you know? Eye is dead.
If, not to dead, but I mean, if you do something, it's gross, you know, to them. It's gross negligence to even think you can discuss something like that with a patient, to say, let me give you something incorrect because that's all we have.
Yeah, 100%. What's your experience, Fish?
Yeah, again, I think you may have substituted in something of how a certain procedure may have to be done by the book with certain other shortcuts or make do of things that were lacking in the system.
Yeah.
And that now just becomes the norm, you know, where people just know, okay, that's how you do it. But that's not actually how we were taught and that's not how you meant to do it.
Mm.
And, you know.
But you're forced to.
It's you could be just be forced to or like.
Like either you have to make that tough decision of should I do something that may help a little bit for this patient, give them suboptimal when I know what the optimal is and explain that to them, or do I not? And also the thing that he doesn't realize is that we are the ones that are conveying the bad news. It's not government that are coming down and they're not coming to the wards and telling you to your face, oh, sorry, we chowed your money. So there's no money for the gloves. There's no money for the lignocaine. There's no money for your operation, whatever it is. We the ones that are bearers of bad news. So obviously people like Tom London are going to look at us like you're the horrible people.
Yeah.
You're horrible.
Yeah.
Why are you? Because we the guys, I mean, it's literally like shooting the messenger.
Mm.
We don't want to be put in that situation. Do you think we also want to be telling our patients, no, we can't help you? No, we'd love to do our job at the best that we possibly can. And again, that's why I feel a lot of doctors go to private because they actually can do what they want and what they know is best for their patient in a system that works.
In a system that's accountable as well.
But you know what he says? All the comments online on my post say, we go to private because we just want to make big, we want to become millionaires and we don't care about our patients. Yeah. We go there to make big money. And the other thing about it is like, okay, yes, we do this because we love our patients and we want them to get the best. But what's wrong with us wanting a nice life? What's wrong with me wanting my kids to go to good schools? You're allowed to do whatever you want to make your money the way you want to make money. If I'm treating you with respect and giving you health, which is the most valuable thing you can have on earth, why should I not be fairly compensated for this? We sacrifice our lives for this. Like,
this is a serious issue, man.
To say that, like, all we care about is money. No, we make this money so that we can take care of our families.
Yeah.
People don't realize we've got other people that we're looking after. We're doing this. But no, all they think of is, no, you want to buy a fancy car and a yacht and this and that. Listen, no doctors are making yacht money. No. If you are seeing patients on a day-to-day basis, that's there not what's no giving you your yacht money. Can guarantee you that.
Doctors, why is it that when a doctor wants to bill or charge or... You looked at like, why are you charging me? Speak to a lawyer.
When we formed the Gents Clinic,
we sat down,
we spoke to the guy for 15 minutes.
He wants
money.
He didn't even,
that was just a consultation. He didn't even draw up our shareholders agreement. And after that, he sent us a bill, 15 minutes, 1,500.
You
would
write a script for a patient and then a week later that you get a message, why did you bill me? I sent you a script. What do you mean? Why did I bill your medical
aid? Love that one. You know, a script. A friend of mine said, an extended like family member or whatever asked him for a prescription for something.
Yeah.
And then he said, yeah, sure, this is how much it's going to cost. And he was like, but why can't you give it to me for free? So he's like, no, this is how much I charge. He's like, why are you charging me? He's like, okay, it's fine. Why don't you write your own script?
Mm.
Then he's like, no, but I can't. And he says, exactly. It took me 9 years, 6 years of medical school, 2 years of internship, and 1 year of community service just to be able to write the script.
To know how to write it even.
That's why I charge
X amount of money. To know what to write. I think that's what they're forgetting.
To know what to write.
What you're writing.
And I'm putting a drug. I'm giving you a drug that I'm putting in your body that you can react to in any
and
which
I
way.
And I will be responsible for that. But I must also, again, we must just do it for free.
Nah.
How many times do family members of you at a family gathering, Chief, I've got a pain here. And you like, Come see me. Come consult at Jens Clinic. No,
yeah. No one's going to come.
Even a friend of a friend will come. And okay, I know this guy. I'm a nice guy. I talk to you for 30 minutes. And then it's like, okay, bye. I'll see if I'll even use your medication. I just spoke to you for like 30 minutes of my time. I wrecked my brain trying to get to the bottom of your issue, you know? And then it's like, no, it's like
on formal consult.
This is the Bettina. No, this is your problem.
This is the Bettina just pulled up. But isn't that the benefit of knowing a doctor or lawyer? The difference is, a lawyer will still charge you. No lawyer friend of yours is going to give you free advice.
Last night she was saying she's going to charge us.
You see,
writing up a contract.
Yes.
Look, perfect. She must charge us. And that's fair.
His wife and was in my car. Remember when Tidi and her friend drove with me from the funeral in the car? Her friend was asking for advice on a certain thing, and then Tidi was giving advice.
Yeah.
Then Tidi was like, I'm sending you a bill for these things I'm telling you. I'm like, huh?
Yes, her friend. Her actual friend.
The friend was like, listen, at work, I have like this assignment we're doing. I don't know how to approach it. So then Tidi started giving like advice, legal advice, how to approach the situation. He's like, I'm sending you a bill. I'm like,
She studied very hard for that.
Yes, and we agree.
And we respect
that. And she's providing
that.
A service.
And we respect that. So respect us also. Sister Bettina, here's my rebuttal.
If you have to speak to a lawyer, you will accept that you have to pay.
Yeah. That's the difference. Why is it that we are treated like we love this, so we must do it for free?
For free.
Mm. For free.
And we do
our
love
own lives.
It.
People be like,
When I go to my landlord, I'm like, how's
my doctor? I love what I do.
I love what I do, man. Just give me a break on the rent. They're not. And that's the thing. Like, they talk about old school doctors versus new school and how we all about the money and back in the day. Back in the day, like, my grandfather was a doctor. His landlord, if you were short on rent, he'd be like, don't worry about it. Mm. It's fine. You're a doctor. I know what you're doing in the community. People would treat us differently. So even if we weren't getting paid, and doctors traditionally, up until like mid-2000s, when people fought for doctors' salaries to rise, doctors were getting paid peanuts. Realistically, they really weren't earning the most in terms of like high-level professions.
It's still peanuts.
The profession, I think people think that our parents or whatever push us into these careers because they think we make money. No, it's a security thing. Mm. You know, everywhere in the world, people are going to be sick and they need a doctor. So it wasn't really ever about money. Like, even my grandfather says, they told him, go be a doctor because you always have a job. But in terms of money, his brother, my grandfather's brother, was a lawyer, retired when he was 45. My grandfather worked until he was 78 years old. Yeah. Tell me the difference.
Yeah.
Look at the difference. He studied 4 years. 4 years, did like 1 year of articles and was done. My grandfather studied 14 years to become a specialist anesthetist and still had to work till he was 78. So please explain to me how that's fair.
How we don't deserve to get millions. Yeah,
we don't deserve to get millions.
And the thing is, it's not even
And he slept in his bed every single night. My grandfather's brother slept in his bed every single night. Do you know that since 2017, when we all started internship, can you remember 1 week where you slept, unless you were on leave, that you slept in your bed every single night?
No.
No, that's unheard of, man.
If you do that...
Sister Bettina, how often you sleep in your bed every night?
Every
night, right? Because you chose a profession that allows you to do that. We literally chose to slave for the rest of our lives, lose our sleep for this profession, and still we must say no.
Yeah,
I'll give you a discount. I'll do this
so
for free.
Think of your salary right now, right? And I don't think many doctors don't know this or haven't like literally looked at it. Mm. Take a third off your salary. That is how much your overtime is. If you decide you want to sleep at home every night, just subtract a third from your salary and
Nassim,
think to yourself.
Sharif, the other doctor that's
he
once said, "Look, I don't want to do overtime anymore," and took a cut from his salary.
That was like four months.
A third of his salary.
It's a lot of money.
And then his department said, look, we'll fire you if you don't want to do overtime.
Yeah.
If you don't want to work nights, if you want to sleep in your bed, you can go somewhere else. We need people who will be willing to come and slave. Yeah.
Yeah. No, man. So, yeah. And then Tom London is probably being treated by the same Dr. Pillay there at in private. The same doctors. Okay, not Dr. Pillay.
Okay, just Dr. Pillay was in our class.
That he mentioned the name. I don't want to mention other doctors' name. It's just that he mentioned Dr. Pillay.
Yeah.
But the same doctor treating him, he could come across in private. that doctor is the same doctor treating.
Exactly. So when he went to private, right, and let's talk about that now. He goes to private. The way he gets to private, he releases this video. A day later, puts out a GoFundMe page. When he puts out the GoFundMe page, whole of society is now saying, we're happy to give this one man money because of how he exposed the system.
Yeah.
And then complained about the doctors, the infrastructure, whatever. And they, I'm sure that most of society was going like, okay, the government's going to do something because this man did it. So let's help him out. Let's get him out of this terrible situation. He goes there. Not only does he get help from society, Gaten McKenzie sends someone from his own department just to escort him into the hospital. We don't know. I can't confirm that Gaten. I can't confirm whether Gaten actually gave money.
No. Yeah.
But what we know for a fact is Gaten assisted him in some way to get him in there.
He said money.
Banyaza Lesufi came to his bedside and chatted to him for 2 hours. He had other members of Gauteng Health Department coming
people need to
him.
Start broadcasting. My black people need to stand up. They had Helen Joseph and broadcast.
Start making videos, man.
I'm sure this guy probably in his poor treatment that he got there, it was still a black person still got worse.
I can guarantee you it was still worse.
Was the black mind that was giving money? Guys, please, if you donated to Tom London, we want to know why, what's the thinking.
We just want to know, and you're entitled to give your money wherever you want to give it. But here's the thing now, right?
So I was just thinking though, so was everyone else getting treated nice in the same cubicle?
No. He also complained like this guy's getting treated badly. Yes. Yeah, we're all getting treated badly. He mentions a situation where they all used to sleep with their phones by their heads.
It's got stolen.
And his phone, in the middle of the night, some psych patient came and stole his phone. The guy opposite the bed said, hey, where's your phone? And then he was like, I can't find it. He's like, I saw someone take it. They find the psych patient in a ward 4 doors down, get the phone back. So he complained about that. He complained about a lot of things, the security in the wards, the treatment by the staff, a whole lot of things. And then he goes to private where he's treated by possibly the same doctors that work in government and private. And then changes his whole tune. In an interview, which Sister Bettina can pull up, he then says, I just want to clarify a few things. The main issues that I wanted to broadcast here was about the doctors.
Yeah.
And their treatment of me. The nurses were great.
Everyone was great.
Even the infrastructure, he suddenly changed his tune. The infrastructure wasn't so bad, but it's actually the doctor's treatment that was poor. And that is what I want to highlight here. Which I feel like,
So
Banyaza Lesufi comes and talks to you for 2 hours. Members of Gauteng government and come chat to you for 2 hours. And suddenly now there's no blame to be put on them.
Yeah, it's all on the doctors.
Suspicious.
So apparently, and I don't know how true this is, because if you see things on X, you don't know how true they are.
Of course.
But apparently Tom London complained a few years ago, a relative of his had severe malaria in rural Mpumalanga.
Yeah.
And he wanted his relative transferred to Steve Biko. And of course, we have a referral system. You don't just refer because
for a reason.
Someone says, I have severe malaria. It's treatable, you know. And apparently made a whole hullabaloo that didn't reach national prominence. But it just tells you the person as well that you're dealing with. Let's also look at the person and see, you know, what's this person's history. He's been raising these things up. And maybe he'd done this.
Okay, well, she can actually pull that up. And while she pulls that up, another thing that a lot of people in my comments have been saying is you guys only now want to jump and complain about the system. Where were you guys before Tom London made this video? Look right here. Rahima Musa, pediatrician, continues to suffer harassment after an open letter. This guy complained about his entire hospital and the his pediatric department for years.
Was he not dismissed?
It was completely dismissed, and they suspended him just for making a complaint.
Yes.
Yeah.
How ridiculous is that? And then they say we don't
speak up. So guys, if I'm suspended after this episode,
just
know they came for me.
Just know they came for all of us.
I mean, look what Prof. Musa came on our podcast and told us when I asked him, should doctors still advocate and make a noise and complain? He was like, yeah, doctors should have a voice. You still have a place, but you need to understand the context. And if you don't have the context and the knowledge, rather keep quiet. I mean, what the hell? I just keep quiet when you know saying those things because
he also had a lot of valid points in terms of facts. You know, of saying yes, it's. I mean, it's good and well to say you know the toilets are not fixed or, but you also need to understand where we come from and what we're dealing with and what the system is dealing with.
I get the fact that the government.
Can I just wait? Helen Joseph was built for a certain group of people.
White people. Yeah. J.G. Stradom. That was the name of the hospital.
And it has a certain number of beds, which was capped just for that one group of people. And now it takes everyone. And there's a lot of foreigners there. There's a lot of Ethiopians. Ness, your sister's there. There's a lot of them there. And I mean, so now they have those added challenges. You know, obviously that's going to affect the infrastructure. That's going to affect staffing and all those kind of things. So that's what he was trying to, I think, pull out of us to say, just don't be too harsh because, you know, it's some of these things are not built for that.
You can't complain about every little thing, especially, I think, if you don't know.
Here's another case of a doctor that left Helen Joseph Hospital, Carol Benn. Right? Yes, Carol Benn was one of the leading breast cancer surgeons.
Taught all of us.
Patients loved her.
And patients loved her. She was well respected by her colleagues. And why did she leave? Because she raised valid concerns about the services that they were not able to provide for their patients. And so what does the department do? Instead of addressing them, they say, let's just weed out these people that are going to complain about us. Literally running it like a mafia.
Yeah.
But we are the problem, guys. We are the problem.
Can you believe this? One of the reasons, and I'm sure it's in that article, if we'll put it in the link in the description. But one of the reasons why they also chased away is because she would take some of the patients at Helen Joseph and consult them in a private surgery at Milpark, or treat them in the surgery at Milpark free of charge at times.
What is it?
You know?
I heard this as well.
Yeah. And obviously there probably was a race issue in that. But I don't want to get into that. What I wanted to say is that I also have a huge problem with the public or other doctors criticizing doctors who offer sort of better service outside of work. You understand?
Yes,
like, for example, I'm going to go back to the Len situation. Let's say I am a sessional worker in a particular hospital. And I work from 8 to 11. And afterwards, I have a private practice. In my private practice, I have all the lenses and all the fancy things that you need, right? And now you're here, you're stuck with this funny lens that someone wants to put just because that's what we have here, or you know, contend with all this nonsense. So am I wrong for saying, listen, yes, it's going to be a bit pricey, and because you're coming from government, I might consider maybe just decreasing my profit margin as well. But hey, I can offer you a better service elsewhere. I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with that because it's a choice. Yeah. I mean, they can say no. I want to stay here and not pay a cent or come. But yeah, it's frowned upon by our colleagues.
Guys watching, take a moment of silence, like 5 seconds, and imagine that you can't get an erection. Your penis doesn't work.
You admire it, man.
There we go. Now, here's my point that I'm bringing. You make sure it works. Someone comes to me, they have erectile dysfunction. I work them up, everything, and I'm like, look, we're at this point, we still need to run more tests, but in the meantime, you need this medication, right? We don't have it here where I'm working at. Please go to where Vishen is working. It's about 5 kilometers away from where I am. When it gets there, they don't have it. And this is many patients. I don't know if things have changed now, but they write a prescription.
You can do a workup, but you can't necessarily treat it.
So the patient would come back to me, and this is at least three. They come back to me from where Vishen is, and they have a prescription like, Dogotela, this thing, I can't get it. It's expensive. I went to the pharmacy. I say, but they don't have it there at the hospital. No, they don't have it. They gave me this. But I'm like, I could have written this. So then I say, like, look here, okay. There is the gentleman's clinic as well. It's much cheaper than at the pharmacy. Maybe we can even reduce, like you're saying, you know, consider reducing the price. It's frowned upon. If I get caught,
in essence, what are we trying to do? We're trying to help you. Exactly. We still have expenses. If we have to, we've got to pay that for that medication ourselves. We've got costs.
Yes.
We've got overheads. We've got all of that, but we're still willing to help. But people don't see that. People only want to see the sensational rubbish that's being spewed now online. That none of us care, none of us make complaints. We're only complaining about the system now that he's complaining. Like
who are going to potentially want to suspend me after this, also take a moment of silence and picture your 4-5 not working. That's before you think, no, I'm chowing this doctor
four, five,
for doing this.
6-9.
You know? So
it is. There's a lot of other medications that also for 6-9, also that, you know, you can't actually access in government.
If you really wanted to. So, but I mean, let's just wrap it up. Man. I think overarchingly, the guy's now in private, right? He decides on his own, well, not on his own volition. He goes and makes his GoFundMe page. He gets funded. He's now there in private. He left all those people he was suffering with behind. Didn't take a cent, and you can guys can correct me if I'm wrong, didn't take a cent to assist those guys.
I don't think his cent, even if he had, would have been enough to take everyone with him.
But true, yeah. True. And that's also a very valid point. He helped himself, which is fair. You can do whatever you want. And if you wanted to help yourself. But now it's very questionable about the motives. And it's very telling of society, I feel, if you're willing to listen to one white man. And I specifically use the race thing because there are thousands of black patients that have suffered. And I know that there's thousands of black patients that have posted videos online that
they
have
also complained.
Have raised the alarm. There's doctors, there's healthcare workers across the board that have made complaints about this and got nothing back. So one white guy makes a complaint, gets out of this crap situation. So this thing that he's complaining about, and the service, and the one thing that blows my mind is he goes to private and he's like, the only thing I'm here to complain about, just to clarify, is the doctors, not the infrastructure. Okay, but those same doctors that were treating you there potentially could be treating you there. So it's the same people. It's just what now? Because they potentially might be getting paid more, they're going to treat you better. Mm. Is that the case? Do you guys think that that's the case? Do we treat our private patients? We've all worked at some point, you know, a little bit at least in private.
Yeah.
Our majority of time has been in state, but do you treat your private patients better just because you're getting paid more? And be honest.
Not just because you're getting paid more. There's ease of resources.
Uh-huh.
There's
number.
There are resources, numbers are less.
So you have the time to
you have the time.
Like what people don't understand is like Helen Joseph, you know how bad Helen Joseph is. I would get anxiety, proper like anxiety going onto a shift. You get there, 30 files waiting. Now, I understand you want a doctor to be kind and compassionate towards you. But when you have 30 files and not even a bed to examine a patient, we were doing CPR on the floor. On my knees.
Sure.
I was on the floor, proper literally BLS. Put a sheet down, not even a sheet, a linen saver down, and we're doing CPR. No drip stands. We tell the intern, hold the bag up whilst we're giving them adrenaline and stuff, while we're resuscitating. Women don't have dignity there. We can't even, we don't even have curtains to cover them whilst we are examining them, doing ECGs on women with their breasts out. Like, this is the reality.
Mm.
What are we supposed to do? Why are we being blamed for that? That's my question. So you can imagine, you're seeing 20 patients. Do you think I have the time to stop and say, hi, how are you, sir? How's your day been? I don't. That's just the reality. There's psychiatric patients screaming. There's a guy who just got shot that's walking in.
Mm.
And it's if that environment was taken to private, the management, the resources would allocate more staff. They would have bigger areas, more beds. Patients would have their dignity. They'd have their doctor that could come to them specifically and chat for 5 minutes before examining them. They'd have that. That's what we're saying. And you'd have a doctor that's going to be kind and caring towards you.
You know,
because
what
of the system.
You know what you're actually advocating for now?
Mm.
Comrade Aaron is going to tell you, but that's what NHI wants to
exactly.
Do.
That's actually what
but it's a
got
lie.
Me thinking.
It's a lie. It's a lie that he's going to do that.
The thing is, I think you were raising, well, questions I was having while you were speaking is, I mean, how are we even there? Because of shortage of staff, right? Because of overcrowded places, because of, you know, all this poor infrastructure and things like that. And the root cause of this is obviously the funding and the financing of these departments and these hospitals. So NHI is trying to address all of that. Oh, well, that's what they say on
that's
paper.
That's what they say.
They're trying to address.
But are we hopeful?
I also just want to clarify some things. I just want to get your opinions as well. So, I mean, I think, Brendan, you know mostly about, like, you can tell us more on biopsychosocial model on how to approach patients and treatment. But it's almost as if, like, you know, I mean, I've never seen the prescription charts or the Balfour charts or anything that was written up for Tom London. But, you know, is it something to say that he was given the wrong treatment?
No,
the
they've done an investigation.
Treatment.
And his treatment was
correct. 100%. You know? He was admitted as a potential LRTI pneumonia, worked up, I think obviously had progressed or was now empyema, possible non-benign lesion or something like that. But ultimately, That means, I mean, I would say the bio part was completely accurate.
Yeah, so from a medical point of view, he got the best treatment, just so that you guys understand.
Yes.
Okay, certain other things which, as we were saying, the toilet facilities, the shower facilities, another patient came from another ward to steal patients' valuables. I mean, can you now function as a guard as well there in the middle of the night?
Yeah, should we now be guards? So,
yeah, they expect you to be a guard.
That's expected to be supported.
So ultimately, I mean, you are there for the... I mean, the main reason you are there is the bio part. Every other part needs to be addressed as well.
Mm.
Psychosocial part, which...
That's a good talking possibly point. What do you think, Brendan? How important is the psychosocial? Because before you answer, I'll just say this. My favorite show when I was a med student was House. You guys remember House?
Yeah, House does not...
House doesn't care. Doesn't care who you are. He doesn't care about your life. He doesn't ask any of those questions. Gets the job done.
Yes.
So I want to know from you, the viewers, comment and let us know whether you would be happy with an excellent doctor that can treat your condition, but he doesn't care about you. He doesn't talk to you. He's not horrible to you. He just doesn't care about your life. Or would you want a doctor that speaks sweet words to you, says nice things, but he's not, he doesn't really know what's cutting.
Mm. So I believe also he was, I think he was waiting quite a while for a CT scan to be done of the chest. So again, I mean, is it something that you say, can you control when your CT, when the patient's CT scan can happen? No, you can't.
You can't control those things, but you can always give information. So I spoke about this with the students at my facility. And again, we must always remember the context that Helen Joseph is and our state hospitals are and the pressure that doctors are under and the culture of doing ward rounds and how they are done and how you arrive at a patient's bed. However, this could have been avoided. I believe it could have been avoided.
Definitely.
You, in your history taking, when you get to the patient's bed and you talk to them, how was the night? You know, how are you feeling today? Is there anything new, you know? In terms of your symptoms. And then, you know, you get now to the psychosocial aspect.
And you communicate, like, you know, the CT scan.
Communicate. So firstly, what do you think about your care that has been going on here so far, you know? Then he'll tell you, doc, I've been waiting for this CT scan and blah, 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 blah. And then you give the information as to what's going on with the CT scan, you know? Then you say, have you got any concerns about what's going on, you know, with your treatment? Or here you are. He'll tell you the toilet's this.
Yeah.
This guy had an LP, you know? He would have vented to the team who came with that psychosocial
Just talking about that as well. Like, you know, obviously you have an issue. Do you, like, naturally... you would vent to the person that's treating you, the doctor or the nurse that's attending
because
you.
Because you have a rapport with them,
You know, that's the first contact that you would have to complain or make issues heard. Thereafter, there's other channels in which to convey these messages as well.
But remember, you won't complain to someone who hasn't made you feel as if they can complain to you. So if the doctors there didn't make him feel as if he can complain to them, his next option was to take a video and post it.
Yeah.
But if he was complaining to the doctors and he didn't get any, you know, he didn't feel like he was heard, there's channels. There's a matron of the ward that you can complain to about these things. Then there's a unit
formal
manager,
formal
complaints, you know. There's then hospital management, there's CEO.
This
there's channels to these things, Hey, sorry?
So this all was done?
No.
I think
he didn't make lay any formal complaint.
Okay.
And I think that was part of his plan. He knew that where his power lies as a journalist was, let me sensationalize a story, as some journalists do.
No, but at the
I'll
same
sensationalize
time,
it. I'll say these doctors are treating us like cockroaches. It evokes an emotional response from society. And then after that, they're going to obviously commit to giving him money, doing whatever he wants. And so I feel like that's why
just
he
raising
went that
awareness
route.
And raising awareness. Because
okay,
I mean how many people fill in comment cards and you know, report this to the matron and only to come to, you know, just a dead end, someone saying, okay, we'll look into that.
But let's be honest, carrying on with what he's saying, the only way we might get change done is if more people complain.
That's true as well.
You know,
true,
like in social media.
And formally.
Formally
so,
through the channels, you
because
know,
we
completely.
It's been shown that we our complaints fall on dead ears as workers.
Well, look, I think it was an interesting chat about the whole situation. I think we can all agree that there are definitely, we're not protecting bad doctors.
Exactly.
There
there's a lot we need to also
There's a lot that we need to reflect on, and there is ways that we can change. And I think the one point that we must take home is that communication is key, particularly if you're working in the government sector. Complain, tell your patients, these are the things we are facing. This is what I'm suffering with, and this is why I can't give you the best care. And also just generally try as much as possible to be as nice to your patients as possible, even through the difficult circumstances. Then on the other side, there's also a majority, I feel, of good doctors and people who genuinely care and genuinely want to help you, but are crumbling under a failing system. How are we going to fix that? I don't know. I don't think NHI is the answer. We do have another podcast episode on that, so you can check that out. But yeah, thank you guys for watching another episode. This is Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Sohail Essa.
Dr. Brendan Matthews.
Santa Vilagazi.
Dr. Vishen Naidu.
Until next time, we'll see you.